Thank you very much for inviting me to give a talk in this very interesting series of lectures. What I would like to do today is to give an overview of the research that I have been doing with my collaborators and my group in the last 20 years on the collective behavior in biological systems and in particular in animal groups. So what you can see in these first slides are two images. On the left, one flock of starlings, and on the right, these are the trajectories of a mosquito swarm. And these are two examples of the kind of systems that we have been looking at in my group. Collective behavior is widespread and ubiquitous in biological systems at many scales. Here you can see several examples, starting from the microscopic scale of cells, bacteria, and other kinds of cells, up to the scale of insects and fish and birds and other animal groups. Behavioral biologists have been interested in this kind of collective behavior for many years. And in particular, there are several examples among these ones where collective behavior is, as biologists say, self-organized. With this, they mean that the collective behavior that we observe is not due to some external factor, like, I don't know, a leader or some external agent, but it is an emergent phenomenon. It is uniquely due to the interactions between individuals in the group. In this respect, this kind of property is similar to what has been observed for a long time in physical systems displaying collective behavior. And this is why collective behavior in biological systems and in animal groups has attracted the interest of physicists in the last 20 years. In particular, there is an even stronger similarity with what is called nowadays active matter. What is active matter? In physics, active matter is that particular branch of condensed matter where we look at systems where the individual units partaking in the system are, so we say, active, in the sense that they have an internal source of energy, let's say a motor, which is able to transform energy into motion. Now, in the case of a living group, in the case of animal groups, this source of energy would be the metabolism that allows a bird or an insect to fly. In the case of non-living active matter, that can be due to different kind of energy input. Here in this slide, you can see a few examples of active matter systems in non-living active matter. So, for example, on the left, this is a picture of tapped rice grains. In the middle, this is a granular matter system where there are small disks that, again, they are. on a disk which is agitated, and therefore there is this energy transmitted to each one of these disks. And on the right, we have some Janus particles which again are set into motion by this magnetic field in this case. So all these are examples of non-living active matter, and in a very similar way to flocks of birds or swarm of insects, we have interacting individuals, each one with a motor, and they display collective patterns. So how do physicists try to describe and understand these systems? In general, the broad perspective, what I've called in this slide the physicist approach, is the following one. Details do not matter. There are just very few features that determine the universal, what is called the universality class of these systems. So if we are interested in understanding the behavior on the large scale, not on the microscopic scale, but on the large scale, on the group scales, we can build very simple models, just precisely because the details of the interactions do not matter. So, for example, just to make a practical example, one of the most famous and celebrated models that has been used by physicists to treat the active matter system, including a flocking system, for example, is the so-called Wittek model. What is the Wittek model? I mean, a very schematic description of the Wittek model can be found in these two equations here. And these two equations describe how an individual particle, an individual bird, if we think at a flock of birds, updates its more important quantity, the quantities that describe how it moves in space, which are the position and the velocity. So the first equation is telling us that when a bird flies, when it has to decide in which direction to fly, it looks at the neighbors, computes an average of the direction of where neighbors are flying, and aligns to that average direction. So this term here is an alignment term, and it is precisely the average direction of neighbors. This index k denotes the neighbors of bird I. And therefore, this term here can be interpreted as a social force. A social force that in the biological context of flocks, for example, would represent the imitative tendency of individuals to follow the behavior of their neighbors. And then there is this xi variable, which just represents noise, just to allow for uncertainty in this average direction estimate that the individuals perform during the motion. Then the second equation just tells us that once each individual computes the next flight direction, it just moves in that direction. And therefore the positional variable is just determined by the direction of motion vi. The fact that these systems are active in the sense that I specified before, namely that each one of them has a motor that allows them to control their speed, is described by a constraint, which is this one, that says that each individual has a fixed speed that is called in this model, in these equations here, is called V0. Okay, so this is, as you can see, a very simple model. It is a very simple model. There are very few parameters. What are the parameters? Here we have this alignment strength, J. And then the other parameters are not clearly visible, but they are there, actually. One parameter is the amplitude of the noise that tells us what is the environmental noise affecting the decision taken by the individuals. And the other parameter is the density of the group. Why the density of the group? Because the denser is the system, the more will be the neighbors close to each individual bird, to which it can refer when computing this average direction of motion that establishes the new flight direction for the reference bird we are looking at. So actually, this is, as I was saying, a very simple model, but people have performed numerical simulations and theoretical analysis of this model, and it is actually very powerful. It is able to give some very qualitative and quantitative predictions that describe quite well, for example, all these examples of non-living active matter that I'm showing you in this slide. So the question that, of course, one would like to ask at this point is, okay, these very simple models and this physicist approach are reasonable and are effective when they are applied to non-living active matter. But do they work when we try to apply them to real biological systems, to real living groups? So the question is a serious question. Why it is a serious question? Because, I mean, in the case of birds or insects or animal groups, the interaction between individuals are not just mechanical interactions or chemical interactions or physical interactions like the ones, for example, that take place in all these systems in this slide. They can be much more complex interactions mediated by cognitive processes, which are the ones that occur when we think at a bird or an insect that just look at the others and make some computations in their mind. So it is not at all a priori evident that this physicist approach, where the details do not matter, can be also applied to animal groups. So what I would like to do now is to show you what we can learn from real experimental data on several examples of animal groups, and whether a simplifying approach of this kind, the ones that physicists have been trying to use also on biological systems like animal groups for many years, is justified or not. So the quick answer to what I'm going to say is that yes, this approach works and it is justified to a large extent, but there are a few specific issues on which we really need to be careful. So what I will be showing you is that flocks of birds and swarms of insects are strongly interacting systems that display large scale properties which are very robust from a statistical point of view. So they are actually, they display those features which are the necessary conditions for the physicist approach to be applied. So in a way, minimal models are justified. We expect them to work. But then once we understand we can use effective minimum model to describe this system, the problem that arises is to find a good model. So the next question one needs to ask once we understand that these systems can be treated with a statistical physics approach is to find the good model or the good universality class, we would say, in statistical physics. To do so, we need to take into account a very important feature, namely the fact that animal groups are large systems, large enough so that they display robust statistical properties, but they are not infinite. We are not in the thermodynamic limit, as we usually, which is what we usually assume in many theories in physics. So what might happen is that the relevant scales for the phenomena that we want to explain are large, but not infinite. And therefore, we need to understand what theories are good and appropriate on those time scales that we are interested into. And the last point that is a consequence of the previous one is that there is a new ingredient which is absent in the Veach-Seck model, which is behavioral inertia, that will turn out to play a crucial role in describing both flocks and swarms. So the two cases I would like to describe more in detail, I would like to discuss, are the ones on which we made most of our experimental observations and theoretical attempts, let's say. And these are flocks of starlings, which you can see in this movie on the left. And the second kind of system I would like to talk about is swarms of insects, and in particular swarms of midges that you can see in the movie on the right. Now, these two systems have a clear difference in that flocks of birds are ordered systems. They display directional order. A flock of birds is a system where all the individuals move in the same direction. Then they can turn if there is an obstacle or if there is a predator arriving, as in the example shown in this movie. But unless there are these perturbations, they just go straight, they follow the same direction. So there is directional order, polar order. This is how it is called in the jargon of active matter. On the contrary, swarms of midges do not display polar order. As you can see, if you look at this swarm on the right, it is fixed on the same position in space. It is not even clear a priori whether individuals are interacting one with the other. If you just look at a swarm, you can think that They are typically swarms form on markers like small ponds. So one can think that each one of them is attracted independently by the pond, but there are no interaction among themselves. Actually, this is not true, and this is one of the first things that we verified. And what happens is that despite this difference in the presence of a global polar order or absence of global polar order, both these cases are cases where there is a strong collective behavior. And I will try to explain a little bit more in which sense we say that there is a strong collective behavior. So to do that, let me explain what is the kind of experimental observations that we perform. We do experiments of stereoscopic photography. This means that we have this experimental setup. Here you can see the setup for acquiring images of flocks. And in this video acquisition system, there are typically multiple observation points. So in this case, for example, you see there are three cameras. In general, there can be more or even less, but when one performs stereoscopic experiments, the minimum of observation points required is two, which is what is shown in this cartoon just below the setup image. So the main idea of stereoscopy is the following. In principle, we have an object in space, in this case, this guy, this bird here, and we want to recover its three-dimensional position and velocity in space, okay? So let's start by the position. If we want to recover the position, if we take one single image, one single photograph of the object, we would get a two-dimensional projection. So for example, if this is the CCD of one camera, we would get this XA, which is the projection of this bird on the X-axis, likewise the one on the Y-axis. But we would miss the third coordinate, Z, which describes the distance from the observation point. However, if instead of taking one single image, we take two, okay, so we have another camera, here camera B, exploiting the geometric relationship of the setup, starting from what is called the stereoscopic shift, namely the difference of the projection in XA and XB, we can retrieve the third missing coordinate. And we can generalize this argument if we think instead of a single image consecutive images, so that we can use this multiple acquisition system to retrieve the full three-dimensional trajectories of the individual birds or insects in a group. This is much more complex than what I'm telling you, but it is a very interesting subject. This is what is called the three-dimensional tracking. However, I do not have the time to explain the details. For those who are interested in our website, there are a lot of explanations and images on both the experiments and the 3D tracking algorithm that we use to retrieve these 3D trajectories. At the end of the day, what we get are these trajectories. And here on the right, you can see two snapshots of the three-dimensional reconstructions of the trajectories of, on the top, a turning flock of birds, and on the bottom, a swarm of insects. Okay, so you can see that in one case, these trajectories are very much aligned one with respect to the other, even though in this case, the flock as a whole is turning, while on the contrary, in the case of the swarm, trajectories are really very erratic. But this is just a qualitative observation. Once we have the trajectories, we can really do a quantitative analysis of all the relevant quantities that can be computed once we have positions and velocities for all the individuals. So the first interesting property that one can look at are correlation functions. So what are correlation functions? Here, what you can see is for a real flock, the projection of the velocities of each individual in the flock. So these small arrows here on the left are the velocities projected on a 2D plane of the birds in this flock. So you can see that this is a flock. So as I already told you, this is a polar system, a system with directional order. And indeed, one can see that all these arrows point more or less in the same direction. A subtle quantity to look at is the individual fluctuation. Namely, what we can do is that we can consider the velocity of each individual and subtract the mean direction of the group. So these are these delta VIs, which are the deviation, the individual deviations. So here on the right, you can see a map of these individual deviations. And what you can immediately see from this figure is that not only, birds tend to fly all in the same direction, but there are strongly correlated regions in these deviations. Namely, all the guys in this part of the flock tend to go more up as with respect to the mean velocity of the group, and these tend to go slightly more down as compared to the mean direction of the group. But these are very large regions. This is a flock of approximately 1,000 individuals, so we are talking here about distances of several tens of meters. Okay, so these are extended regions. So if we want to quantify how large these regions are, we can look at the correlation function. The correlation function is defined in this way, and it measures how the deviation of a certain bird I is correlated with the deviation of a certain bird j, which is found at a given distance r from I. So it measures how much an individual in a position of the flock is able to influence another individual which is distant r from it, okay? So these connected correlation functions, this is how they are called, identify regions of coherent behavior in the group. So how do they look? So this is typically how these correlation functions look like. So on the top row, you can see the correlation function, an example of correlation function for a flock. So you can see that this correlation function decreases, and at some point it crosses zero. So we can use this R0, this point here, as a proxy of the extension of these correlated domains. Okay, and one can verify that this is actually a bona fide measure of these correlated domains. On the right, you can see how this extension of the correlated domain scales with the size of the flock. We have several flocks. So we have acquisitions of flocks of many different sizes. So we can ask how big are these correlated domains in small flocks and larger flocks and larger flocks and so on. And what we find is that this correlation length, this is how it's called, this R0, this correlation length scales linearly with the size of the system. In other words, we can rephrase this result by saying that whatever is the size of the system, individuals are correlated with each other in regions of the size of the group itself. Therefore, correlations are group spanning, or another way of saying the same thing, are scale free. The same kind of behavior is also found in swarms. So on the bottom row, you can see exactly the same quantities defined in the same way, computed for swarms of insects. Here in this small figure, you can see the global degree of alignment, which is in the case of flocks is very close to one because flocks are very ordered. In the case of swarms, it is around zero because they are not ordered at all. So the conclusion of this analysis is that irrespective of the presence of order, both flock and swarms are highly correlated groups where individuals are able to influence each other also on scales of the extension of the group itself, okay? So now the question that one can ask is whether this property, which is surely non-trivial, can be explained by the simple model that I have introduced in my previous slides, which is the Vitchsack model. And the answer to this question is yes, at a qualitative level, the Vitchsack model, like models which are based on alignment, on the fact that individuals tend to align to each other, are able to explain scale-free correlations in both the case of ordered system and of disordered system. In the case of swarms, what one needs is that even though the system is disordered, it must be very close to an ordering transition, which is what we think happens in natural swarms. They are not ordered, but they are very close to an ordering transition. And precisely being so close to an ordering transition allows for these scale-free correlations. So far, so good. It seems that this Wittek model, if we want to explain the presence of collective behavior in the sense of strong correlations, it gives a good description. Problems start arising when we look at more detailed features. For example, features when we look at the behavior of the system at different times. So in this slide, these correlation functions, they look at how individuals are correlated at a given distance, but at the same time. But one can generalize this kind of approach and look at what happens when I look at my system at a given time and at another time. So we performed this kind of more subtle analysis on both flocks and swarms, even though with different approaches. So let me start by describing what we did for flocks of birds. In the case of flock of birds, we could acquire several video acquisitions of flocks that were performing collective turns. So here on the left, you can see the real video acquisition of a natural flock performing a turn. And here on the right, you can see the three-dimensional reconstruction of the same event, okay? So you can see that these individuals perform these very neat turns. And it seems that they are very similar in terms of space trajectory. Each of these different colors correspond to a different individual trajectory. On top of that, since we have the data, we can look more precisely at what happens in time. And what we discover is that the turn is not instantaneous. I mean, it's not that everybody is turning at the same instant of time, but there is a propagation of this process. Namely, there is a first guy who starts turning, and then the nearby guys start turning, and then the guys close to the nearby guys start turning and so on. Therefore, this means that there is a sort of wave of propagation of this directional perturbation, which starts in one specific location in the group, one specific guy in the group, and then propagates through the whole group. Here in this figure here, you can see a color map that quantifies how this propagation occurs through the group. Red individuals are those who start turning first, and then yellow ones are the following ones, and so on, until when the light blue ones are the last individuals to turn. We can even be more quantitative when describing this phenomenon, because what we can do is that we can compute these propagation curves. Namely, if you look here on the right, each different color corresponds to a different flocking turn, different flocks, different turns. And what we report here is the position of a certain guy, I, who is the guy that is starting to turn at the time to I. So the first guy here in this plot would be the initiator of the turn, and then we would find the second individuals to turn, and this is their position with respect to the initiator and the time at which they are turning, and so on. So this is a propagation curve, let's say the curve that describes how this turning event propagates through the flow. And what is visible from this figure is that in all these events, there is a very clear linear regime where space increases proportionally to time. So this is what we in physics we call a linear propagation law. We have this turning front, and the front propagates linearly in time. Okay, the position of the front propagates linearly in time. So let's try to understand whether whether this behavior is described in the appropriate way by the Vitchsack model. This seems a quite technical slide, but I will try to explain in intuitive terms. So this first equation here is just a schematic description of the Vitchsack model, which is the one that I already wrote in one of my first slides. But it can be rewritten in a mathematical formulation, which is approximate but easier to handle. So let's assume that we are in two dimensions. And this is approximately correct because these flocks, they are three-dimensional, but they basically turn on a plane, as we saw from the movie in my previous slide. So if we are in 2D, what we can see is that the velocity of each individual bird is specified by an angle, this phi I here, which is the angle with respect to the average group motion, the mean group motion, this big V here. Okay, so these the increment on this the difference between the flight directions of the bird at two different times, if we assume small time intervals, can be rewritten as a derivative, and instead of using the full velocity vector, we can use this angle phi, which is a scalar, and it is easier to handle. So we would get on the left-hand side the derivative of this angle phi with respect to time. This alignment term here, if we assume that this angle varies smoothly from an individual to the next one, can be reformulated as a Laplacian. So one can, looking a little bit more in detail at this term here, one realizes that this is a discrete Laplacian, so that in the continuum limit, when this variation of the angle are very smooth in space, we can replace this with a Laplacian, and the noise remains the noise. Now, from this rewritten in this way, the propagation law is very easy to obtain, because I mean one can just go in Fourier space, and what one would get is this dispersion law between the frequency and the k vector, which correspond to a square root dependence on the position of the propagation front from time. Therefore, we understand that the Vitchsack model does not describe what we observe in the data. First of all, the propagation law is not linear, but it has a square root. And on top of that, one can also show that there is damping. So this I factor here, this imaginary factor here, means that if there is a small perturbation, if the initiator performs a certain deviation, then the following individuals will have a deviation that is progressively damped. So information propagates as a square root and in a damped way. And this is not what is observed in the data. So this is for physicists, this is immediately clear once we look at this equation, because this is a typical equation of a diffusive damped dynamics, okay, with where the first order, when the first order derivative in time dominates, regulates the dynamics of the relevant degrees of freedom of the system, which in this case is the angle phi. So what should we do if we want to reproduce the linear dispersion law that we observe in the data? Okay, if we do a sort of reverse engineering, we know that to get linear dispersion law, one needs to think at wave equations. So at equations where the force, which is here on the right-hand side, does not act on phi, but on the derivative of phi. So that in the end, one would not have a derivative here, a first order derivative, but a second order derivative. So one can think, just for the sake of getting a linear dispersion law, to substitute this first order derivative with a second order derivative, okay? Actually, this is also what seems the most reasonable thing to do from the biological point of view. Why? Because the Wittgenstein model is assuming that this social force, this alignment force, remember that this is the social force exerted by neighbors on a given individual, is able to change very quickly the direction of motion of the individual that we are looking at. But this is not what actually happens, because if a bird has to change direction, it cannot do it arbitrarily quick. Because for just mechanical reasons and also for processing reasons, it requires more time to implement the information that it receives. This is to say that there is a certain inertia driving the way individuals process information. And the inertia comes always with second derivatives. And this is another way, another reason why a second order derivative in this equation looks more reasonable. But I mean, if you just assume that there is a second order derivative, not only we would get a linear dispersion rho, we would also get a prediction for the propagation speed. Propagation speed, that is the slope of these curves here. So this is something that we can measure from the data. We have a prediction for this model. We just can compare predictions with what we get from the data to understand whether our modeling is correct or not. And this is what we get. So the red points are the speed as measured from the data. And the straight line would be in the variable that appear in this graph, the predicted behavior of the model, which is non-trivial at all, because it would involve a non-trivial combination of the observables in our system. Here, phi is the polarization, the global degree of alignment. So the conclusion of this analysis is that actually we understand by looking at the data that a good model should include a second order derivative in time. Then it might be that this is an oversimplification of what we should put in a model. Maybe we should put this second order derivative, but there are also dissipation effects, so we should also include a first order derivative. But for sure, if we want to reproduce this linear propagation law, we need to put this second order derivative. Now, here on the left, I've just written another way to rewrite this second order equation. What is this other way? This other way is to introduce an auxiliary variable that I've called S here, which is nothing else than the derivative of the angle itself. So it's a sort of internal angular momentum of these birds. So it is a quantity that such that when a force acts on these birds, this quantity can increase and make the bird turn. Okay, so it can be seen as an auxiliary variable from the mathematical point of view, but actually from the physical point of view, it has a precise meaning, because this is the generator of the symmetry of our system. Our system, both flocks and swarms, are systems where there is a rotational symmetry. If I change the angle of every velocity by the same amount, the system behaves in the same way. So there is an important rotational symmetry, and this is the generator of that symmetry. So it is not only a quantity that has a mathematical value, but it also has a physical interpretation. And it will be useful in the following. That's why I'm introducing it. So if one wants to generalize through three dimensions the new model with this inertia, this rotational inertia, and second order derivatives, one would get the following model here. Just let's start looking at the bottom line. The bottom line, you can see that if I just forget the second order derivatives, these first two terms, okay, I am left with the Wittgenstein model. So there are these two additional terms which comes with this rotational inertia that appears if I want to take into account all this new dynamical ingredient that I need if I want to reproduce the linear propagation law. Okay, so this is, if you want, the minimal possible generalization of the Wittgenstein model that allows for linear propagation. Okay, And we have just one parameters more than the ones that we have in the Vigisec model. So it is minimal, but it is able to reproduce experimental data that the Vigisec model was not able to reproduce. And indeed, if one performs simulations of these models, what one can see is that when in the overdamp, the limit where the model is equivalent to the Vigisec model, if I make an individual turn, all the other ones will not follow and one is not able to reproduce collective turns. On the contrary, if I am in the underdamp limit of this model where the second order derivative dominates, then what I would get is that the model reproduces the collective turns. So this model has two regimes, one regime that behaves like the Vigisec model, and another regime, which is dominated by this inertia, where there is a linear propagation law and the model reproduces what observed in real flux. Now, the important point is that these regimes are determined by the parameters in the model, okay? So dissipation versus inertia, how the second order term, derivative term, compares with the first order derivative terms. But it is also determined by the size of the system. So this means that if I look at small enough, given the parameters of my model, if I look at small enough groups, they can be large, but I mean, small enough with respect to a certain scale. If I look to groups which are smaller by this certain scale, I observe flock-like behavior, natural flock-like behavior. If I consider sizes which are much larger than this crossover scale, then I would start observing the Vigisec phenomenology, okay? And here you can see what is the value of this crossover length scale as a function of the parameter of the model. Okay, so the message of this first part of this analysis is that first point, we need to take into account the behavioral inertia and second order derivatives because everything occurs very smoothly in natural systems. And the second point is that these second order derivative and this behavioral inertia are relevant because the groups that we are observing are finite and the phenomena that we are observing, namely the turning of a flock, occurs on finite timescales. Therefore, since the relevant timescales and spatial scales that we are interested in are finite, we need to put into the dynamical equations all those ingredients that contribute to that timescales. Okay, so as I will try to show you, something similar occurs also when we try to understand what happens from a dynamical point of view in swarms. So in this case, here, what I'm showing you are experiments performed on swarms of midges. Here on the left, you can see a swarm of approximately 600 individuals. And on the right, you can see the three-dimensional reconstructions. Now, as compared to flocks, since swarms are on a fixed point in space, we can take much longer video acquisitions. This is not possible in flocks because we have our acquisition set up and the flock enters the field of view of our cameras for a certain amount of time. But since they are going almost straight, then they go out to field of view. Therefore, we are limited in the length of the video acquisitions by this problem that they are polar systems. They are moving in a given direction. This is not what happens in swarms. They are always there. So we can take much longer time acquisitions. So this allows us to compute the time, space-time generalization of the correlation function that I have introduced several slides ago. So what I previously introduced is what I've called the C of R. Namely, the correlation function between the deviation of a given individual in a certain position and another individual at a given distance R from the first one. And these deviations are considered at the same instant of time. I can generalize, and I can do something similar, but at different times. So I look at a certain bird eye at a certain time T0. I compute its deviation, delta vi at zero, and then I look at another guy, j, which is found at a given distance from the first one, and I look at the deviation of this second individual at another time, t0 plus t, as compared to the time t0 of the first individual. So in this way, what I can compute is the space-time correlation function. The formal definition is here on the right, but I mean, this is just a delta function that implements the distance and the time between the pair of individuals that I am considering. It is convenient to, for just practical reasons, so to look at this quantity here in Fourier space as, with respect to the space variable. So if I introduce the wave vector k, that is the Fourier mod related to the distance r, okay, I can define a correlation function c of k and t. So this is a function that, just to briefly explain its meaning, it describes the correlation between individuals at distances which are of the order of 1 over k, okay? This is the way that we can picture this this correlation function here, and just by Fourier transforming the top expression, one would get this second one. So here on the left, what you can see is the correlation, this correlation function here, normalized by the value in zero, so that we can compare different wave vector and different swarms in a fair way. So this is normalized correlation function, time dependent, for a given swarm at different scales. So these are the different scales we have been looking at. Alternatively, one could also do something slightly different. One could fix the scale so that I fix the k and look at the correlation function for different swarms. One would get a very similar picture, where in the second case, the different colors would stand for different swarms, so while in this figure here, different colors stands for different k values. So the question that now we would like to ask is, okay, what we can see is that here is an important information, namely, if we look at different scale, these correlations decay on different timescales. So for example, here, the lightest value is the largest value of k, okay, and this light curve here, and we see that it would decay on a certain time scale, which is this one, okay, and then this is the smallest value of k. Then as we increase the value of k, we would get a quicker decay in time. So this figure is telling us that the decay of this correlation depends on the scale at which we look. So is there a way to describe in a compact and understandable way all these curves here? Because if I just look at this curve, this might just mean, okay, look, I have to consider each one of these decay curves independently from each other. Actually, this is not true, because what we can check is whether a certain important hypothesis, which holds in physical systems, also holds in swarms. What is this hypothesis? This hypothesis is what is called the dynamic scaling hypothesis, and it is an hypothesis that simplifies very much the description of the dynamical behavior of a system. So we are considering this observable, the correlation function at different scales and different times. In principle, this correlation function depends on a certain amount of parameters. So for example, it might depend by the size of the swarm, by the number of individuals in the swarm. It might depend by the strength of the wind. It might depend by the environmental conditions, a certain number of external parameters that here I have just called alpha 1, alpha 2, alpha n, okay? So this dynamic scaling hypothesis is based on two assumptions. The first assumption is that these correlations here depend on these control parameters only through the correlation length. So the correlation length of the system, which is the extension of the correlated domains that I introduced in my previous slides, depends on the control parameters. But once I know this dependence, the correlation function only depends on Xi. It does not depend on this alpha directly. It depends on the alphas only through Xi. And the second assumption is that larger regions decorrelate on larger times, which is what we qualitatively saw in this picture here. Larger regions decorrelate on larger times, but the dynamics scaling hypothesis quantifies, specifies how this relation should be written. Namely, it says that the correlation time on a certain scale k should depend on 1 over k to a certain exponent z, which is called the dynamic exponent. So it formulates these two very strong hypotheses. But the interesting point is, if these hypotheses hold, then what we can do is that we can rewrite our correlation function as a function of some reduced variables. Time over this characteristic time scale depending on k, and the correlation length multiplied by k. Namely, once distances are measured in units of correlation lengths and times in units of correlation times, every correlation function should look the same. Okay? So if one starts from this formalization, this is just a mathematical formalization of this dynamic scaling hypothesis. If you can see that if we set kxi equal to a constant, then the correlation function should only depend on this product, k to the z multiplied by t. And the correlation time should scale as k to the minus z. Now, this seems complicated, but this is something that we can very easily look in the data. So we have data for different swarms, therefore with different values of xi. We can choose k, so we can set kxi equal to a constant that we choose. We chose 1, okay? And we can see whether once we fix kxi equal to 1, all the correlation functions collapse one on top of the other, okay? And this is what is shown here. So here you see in this first plot, correlations functions at a given value of k equal 1 over xi, for several different swarms. So in this picture, we have 5 different swarms. Different means different swarms, different days, different years, different species as well. They are not all the same species of insect. We also put together different species, okay? And then we try, this is the C of K and T plotted as a function of T. But now what we try to do is we try to replot this function in terms of this combined variable, okay? And we try to find a value of Z that makes them collapse all together. And what we can see is that actually there is a value of Z for which all the curves collapse one on top of the other. And this value of Z is of the order of 1. And it is also the same exponent that well reproduces how the decorrelation time scales with K. Okay, so this might seem slightly complicated, but actually it is a way of describing all the swarms with the same quantity. And this quantity is this exponent here that is called dynamic critical exponent. So the result of this analysis is that swarms obey dynamic scaling, which is a very, very strong property, a robust property that has been observed and verified in physical systems. But I mean, it is quite surprising to find it observed in such a nice way also in a biological group, okay? And that the exponent is this z equal to 1. If we do the same thing with the Vitsack model, because we can do that, the same analysis, exactly the same analysis with the Vitsack model, we find that scaling is obeyed, but this is by construction, this model must obey scaling, and that the dynamic exponent is different. So the dynamic exponent is what usually in physics corresponds to what is called the dynamic universality class. Namely, it specifies the class of dynamical behavior. So this result is telling us that also for swarms, so the Switch-Sec model is not appropriate because the dynamic universality class, the class of dynamical behavior, is different because this critical dynamic exponent is different. So in the last few minutes, I would like to discuss the next theoretical question that we can ask ourselves after this experimental result. So I have argued when discussing propagation information in flocks that an important ingredient that was missing in the simple Witch-Sec model was this behavioral inertia. Behavioral inertia that is related to the second order derivative in time, that is related to a reversible kind of dynamics that we need to put into the equation, the second order derivative, basically. So one can ask whether behavioral inertia and the second order derivative terms are also relevant to explain this behavior in swarms. So to try to understand whether this is relevant or not, from the theoretical point of view, one needs to understand how can we predict, compute this dynamic critical exponent. So usually to do that, an agent-based description like the one of the Witch-Sec equation is not useful unless one performs numerical simulations, but to have an analytical prediction of the exponent, one has to resort to a field theory approach. What does it mean? It means that here I just draw a very pictorial description of a swarm or a flock or whatever you want, and the Witch-Sec model specifies the dynamical equation of each individual here. If we want to build a field theory, we need to coarse grain our system, which means that we assume that we have a large enough system. We just look at the small box, okay, which is small enough as compared to the global size of the group, but it is large enough as to contain many individuals. And we define some continuous fields within each one of these volumes. So namely, we take the average density within this volume, and we define a density field, which is defined in the center point of this volume. And likewise, we can define the velocity field, defined in the same way. And if we want to describe also an inertial kind of dynamics, we need to introduce a third field, which is this generalized angular momentum that I've introduced also in the macroscopic description, and that I had called S, and I keep calling it S here. So we have a coarse-grained hydrodynamic, and then one just coarse-grains all the equations and writes down equation for these fields. So one would get field equations, and if I want to retain all the relevant observables, I need to put the three of them, okay? That would give me a very complicated field theory with three coupled fields. So if one wants, just to mention some analyses that have been performed in the past, there are several analyses that were performed in the 70s where basically people looked at models with these alignment interactions, but on a lattice. And these were these first two models, okay? Either with dissipative or conservative dynamics, just first derivative or second derivative. And then there have also been some analyses for particles that move, so they are self-propelled, like in the Witch-Sec model, but they do not have this second-order derivative. They don't have inertial terms, and these are these third models. So, and people have performed these computations; they are very complicated. But then these are the values for the exponents. From these examples, one can draw a conclusion, an indication, a suggestion. The suggestion is that both behavioral inertia, both inertial terms and self-propulsion tend to decrease the exponent. So what we would like to do is to build a theory that has self-propulsion, so it treats moving particles, not particles on a lattice, but that also has this behavioral inertia term that were discarded for a long time. So we started, since people had been investigating the role of self-propulsion, we started to look at the role of behavioral inertia. And these are the field equations of these dynamics on a lattice. So this is a first step. We first study what happens on a lattice, and then we allow for self-propulsion. So this is already a difficult problem to solve, but I mean, we solved it using an RG computation. And the result of this computation is that if we don't put behavioral inertia, then we would get this exponent here, z equal to 2. If we add this behavioral inertia, namely we add this coupled S field to the dynamics of psi, then there is another important dynamical regime, which corresponds to an exponent which is 1.5. Okay? And the regime that is relevant for the system depends on the size of the system itself. If the system is small enough, it is regulated by this dynamical critical exponent. If the system is beyond a certain crossover length scale, it is dominated by a dissipative kind of exponent. Okay, so once again, we arrive to the conclusion that I've already discussed, namely the fact that inertia is important, but it is important precisely because since we are looking at finite timescales, large but finite timescales, our system is in a regime where behavioral inertia counts. So, I mean, Wiechsek was right in a way. If I have a fluid with an infinite number of particles moving, then it's true. I mean, I can disregard these second order derivative terms. I can coarse grain my dynamics, and what dominates is dissipation, is a dissipative dynamic. But if I'm interested in systems that are finite, then I need to take into account the smoother kind of dynamics, which is described by an inertial model. Okay, so with this, I think I can. This is just what I was telling you. There is this length scale that this discriminates between different dynamical regimes, and this is what mainly what I wanted to say. And I can summarize all the results that I've been discussing in this slide. The bottom line of all our research in the last years is that behavioral inertia plays a crucial role in biological groups. In flocks of birds, it grants lossless propagation of information at large global order, because linear propagation law is the most efficient way to quickly propagate information through the group. And it grants a quick adaptation close to criticality, which is what occurs in swarms of insects, which are close to an ordering transition, close to a critical point. And they have this Z exponent, which is lower than what expected in other kind of in other classes of dynamical behavior. So this, that the one that we have observed, that correspond to a novel class of dynamical behavior. And the important point is that the finite size of the system is very important because it determines the dynamical regime, which is relevant for what we want to explain. Finally, what we are working on now, what I have been discussing, is that inertia and activity, as I was telling you, both tend to lower the dynamical exponent. So what we are doing now, and it's very complicated, but we are trying to study the full theory, the theory where we have inertia, and therefore we have this S field, we have the velocity field, and we also have the density field. I mean, we have also the activity, the self-propulsion of the individuals. And what we hope is that the contributions of these two effects, which both tend to lower the exponent, would be able to produce an exponent which is closer to the experimentally observed one, which is 1.2. Okay, and we are close to finish this computation. So I just want to finish by thanking all my collaborators, my main collaborator, Andrea Cavagna, and several other collaborators who contributed to several parts of the work I have been discussing, Tomás Grijera and Stefania Massignano Leonardo, who are the researcher in our group, and all the postdocs and students who helped us to derive models and perform experiments. So thank you.
Thank you very much, Irene. This is a beautiful work and totally fascinating. And I think it fits very well the kind of ideas that I was trying to discuss earlier in the morning. So I had a few questions. One is about criticality. So you insist a lot on the fact that these systems are in a way close to criticality. Can you expand a little bit on this idea? Why should that be so? Is there a biological reason for that to be so? Are there alternative explanations for this apparent criticality?
Okay, so thank you for this question, which is a very interesting one. So I'm going back to the slide where I discussed the correlation functions. So actually, I talked about being close to a critical point only in the case of swarms, okay? So the starting point, what we observe in the data is that there are these scale-free correlations. So one can ask, okay, when can I have scale-free correlations? Okay, so in the case of an ordered system, and this is the case of flocks, scale-free correlations are not due to a critical effect. They are due to the fact that the system is in a region where there are soft modes that cost very, very little, that allows the global order parameter to fluctuate. It's every model with or every system which has a continuous rotational symmetry in the phase where the symmetry is spontaneously broken has these soft modes. And so in the case of flocks, we expect to find the scale-free correlations as a consequence of the fact that the system is ordered and it has broken spontaneously a rotational symmetry, which is the rotational symmetry of the velocities. Okay, namely, this means if a flock could be a priori ordered in any direction, all directions are equivalent. There is not any privileged direction. So when order is established through these interactions, it can be anywhere in terms of direction in space, but one direction is selected. Nevertheless, since all directions are equivalent, fluctuations around this direction cost very little, and this is why one gets these soft modes and these scale-free correlations. This, can be proven with models, with theories. There are many, many analyses that explain these scale-free correlations in the ordered phase. On the contrary,
I interrupt for 1 second before you go to Mitch's, but I seem to remember that in a paper where you try to reproduce more complicated correlation functions with Bialik, I think, based on maximum entropy considerations, you kind of found that the coupling parameter was still close to critical.
Yes, but not for directions. So that was for the speeds. So this is true, but I've not talked about that here.
Okay.
That's very interesting, but would have implied a whole different discussion. There are other degrees of freedom that are critical, but they are not the ones that I have displayed here.
Okay. Thank you for clarifying. Okay.
Yeah. So directions, so they're just soft modes. There are other degrees of freedom, you're right, but I didn't talk about that. In the case of swarms, since they are in the disordered phase, one cannot invoke such a symmetry argument to explain the presence of scale-free correlations. And therefore, the natural explanation, it's not the only one, but a natural explanation is that the system is close to an ordering transition. Actually, this can be substantiated by more analysis than the one I'm showing you here. So for example, one can compute the susceptibility, the integrated correlation and show that it behaves as if in a scaling region. Okay, one can compute other quantities and show that they behave as if they were close to a critical ordering transition. So why is that? This is a very interesting question. Why should a swarm be close to a critical point? Well, if we think that correlations are somehow related to response, okay, which is what happens in physical systems, here we can assume that something of the same kind also occurs, even though it has not been really verified, okay, experimentally. But we can assume that if individuals are very much correlated one with the others, therefore these correlations are extended, if something from the outside arrives, the system would respond collectively. So the presence of scale-free correlations would imply that the group is able to respond collectively to external perturbations or signals, okay? And this would certainly be, from a biological point of view, would certainly be important for the group. How the group implements the conditions that allows it to be critical is also an interesting question. So what might be is just to speculate. Okay, this is speculation. But what might be is just that, you know, swarms form in our experiments over a marker. We set a marker which is like a reflective shield on the ground to induce the formation of a swarm. Okay, it's like an artificial pond because it reflects light. It's a spot that reflects light and tries to emulate what would be the effect of a natural pond. And so we set these markers, and at some point these swarms start to form. And we can think that there is a sort of aggregation process such that more and more individuals try to join the group. And as individuals keep joining the group, the density of the group slightly increases and the number slightly increases. And these two quantities, density and number, self-regulate each other in such a way as to reach a pseudo-critical point. So that, I mean, the correlation is maximal, so that if more individuals are added, they are simply outside this correlation length and get dispersed. And the group remains in such a way that it is maximally collective. So this could be an explanation.
Okay, yes. So I wanted you to speculate, so that's good. But in the end, you said implicitly that if you look at other quantities also for birds, there are some sign of criticality, right? So
For the speed, you mean the other degrees of freedom that I did
yes. not. So in a way, birds are also managing to be close to a critical point.
Birds are also managing being close to a critical point, but a different one.
Yes, yes.
So
sure.
It's a zero temperature critical point. It's not a finite temperature critical point. Yeah.
So you showed these beautiful simulations where you clearly see the difference between the Wycheck model, where one bird changes direction and ends up being alone, and the model with inertia, where you allow the whole flock to turn simultaneously. Something also that you see in the videos, which is striking, is when the predator attacks, the flock is able to split into two. Can you reproduce that within the same model, at least qualitatively, with a simulation? Can you understand what's going on?
Okay, so we didn't try to look in that direction. This is something that can be done, actually. There are several details that one needs to think about when performing this kind of analysis. And
would it be that two birds take two different decisions and then they kind of break the herd in two, or is it too naive?
I think it would also depend on the detailed structure of the interaction network when the perturbation occurs. So these simulations that I'm showing you here, they have a very homogeneous network between the individuals. So we set individuals in such a way that more or less each guy interacts with an equivalent number of other guys. It might be that during flight, these interactions is more heterogeneous. This interaction network is more heterogeneous. So that, for example, there are regions of the network where certain guys see some other guys, but the other guys don't see those guys, the first guys. So, because in principle, the real network could be asymmetric. Mm-hmm. And I think that would be very important in determining how a perturbation would act on the system. Because, it could break it in different ways, or it could not break it at all, according to how the network is. So, for example, there is a student of mine who is now looking more in details at this perturbation experiment on very simple models. And if you apply at random, if you apply a field on a magnetic field coupled to the individual velocity of a given bird, and you applied it in a simulation, so you applied it at random at certain instant of time, so on just one guy, then what might happen if you look at periodic boundary conditions in a simulation and so on, is that the guy you chose in which applying your perturbation is at that instant of time is not connected with other ones. Then, in absence of the perturbation, it might become connected at later times, but not at the time in which you apply the field. And then what happens in this case is that the field acts on the guy who goes away, but not on the rest of the flock. So, the instantaneous network configuration of the network might be important to explain how the perturbation really, the real effect of the perturbation, let's say.
But so you've looked at hundreds of flocks in your life, I guess. Do you see them splitting into more than two sometimes?
No. What you see is that there is a very big difference when you look at very large flocks. So clearly, when you look at small flocks, the ones that we are able to process with our 3D tracking algorithm, you see these flocks that turn, you see these flocks that when the falcon arrives, maybe they split, but they come back together. In the movie, that they eventually come back together. You can see this phenomena here. When you look at very large flocks, hundreds of thousands of individuals, we don't have the 3D reconstruction, but it seems by eye that the phenomenology is different. You can even see by eye very strong deformations of the group. Mm-hmm. You see that the group that does not tend to move, but it remains there when there are predatory attacks. This is qualitative. This is just looking at them. So it might really be that there are these different dynamical regimes such that if the flocks are really large enough, then dumping and dissipation come into play, and you have these strong deformations, which are basically due to that.
Uh-huh. As you expect. Mm. Good. So I had also a technical question about the correlation functions that you measure. So I agree that it's the most obvious thing to do to look at the correlation function as a function of the distance between two points. Mm-hmm. But actually, because the flock is a finite size and also because it has a certain direction, you might try to define more complicated correlation functions. So, for example, the correlation function that you measure might be a function of the distance between the center of mass of the two guys and the center of mass of the flock, or the correlation function could be also a function of the angle between the two guys and the global direction of the flocks. So I guess that you've looked at these things as well. Can you draw any conclusion from what you've seen?
Okay, so we there is work to do in that direction, but we try to look at the correlation functions also depending on the angles, but there is not a good statistics, I have to say. We don't have flocks that are so large as to allow for statistically robust analysis in this sense. On top of that, flocks are very they are pancake-like. So there is one direction which is truly much shorter than the other two, which makes things even more complicated, because as you go in one direction, you are immediately at the border. So when one needs a little bit to take into account the boundary effect, the effect due to the boundary, and once you start looking at quantities that also depend on the angle, that might complicate the statistics a lot. But we recently had an exchange about possible other quantities to compute with the other researchers that suggested us things to look at, and we might be looking at those and see whether we can see some significant behavior, let's say.
Because in a sense, here you've averaged over all directions.
All directions, but
but you could do, without going to the full dependence on angle, you could do a kind of harmonic expansion.
That was what we wanted to look at, basically.
Okay, I see. Very nice.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, thank you very much again. This was great. And I hope that people will look more into the papers that you've written on the subject. Thank you very much, Irene.
Thank you.